There are a lot of winds buffeting the American economy right now. Inflation is at its highest rate in 3 decades and could go higher when the new numbers come out on December 10th. A muddled November jobs report fell far short of expectations in terms of the number of new jobs added, yet the unemployment rate sank to 4.2%, less than a percentage point above where it was when the pandemic began. The uncertainty of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus is making the next few months even harder to predict. But this December, what is going on in Washington is injecting another shot of uncertainty into the economic mix. While Congress has approved a landmark infrastructure bill and staved off, for the moment, a government shutdown, there are 3 major unresolved issues that have potentially significant implications for the economy, the markets, and investors, not just over the short term, but potentially for years to come. Welcome to Washington Wise Investor, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. I'm your host, Mike Townsend, and on this show, our goal is to cut through the noise and confusion of the nation's capital and help investors figure out what's really worth paying attention to. This is our last show for 2021, so today I want to focus on where things stand on these 3 key issues. The first is the debt ceiling. A plan is in the works to raise it, but until the final vote is taken, there continues to be a possibility that the United States could default on its debts for the first time in its history. The second is the Build Back Better Act, the massive spending bill to combat climate change and strengthen the social safety net, which represents the heart of President Joe Biden's domestic agenda. It's pending in the Senate, but it still faces a number of hurdles that are likely to delay final action on the bill until early 2022. And the third has perhaps the longest reach of all, the opportunity for President Biden to reshape the Federal Reserve in a way that could affect monetary policy, financial regulation, and the direction of the economy for the next decade. I'll dive into each of these issues in just a moment, but let's begin with the resolution of last week's drama, in which Congress managed once again to avert a government shutdown. This is an all too familiar scenario. Indeed, just 2 months ago, having failed to pass any of the 12 appropriations bills that fund every federal agency and program by the time the government's fiscal year began on October 1st, Congress was facing a potential shutdown. At the last minute, lawmakers approved a temporary measure to keep the government funded through December 3rd, last Friday. 2 months later, Congress still has not passed a single one of those 12 appropriations bills, and that meant lawmakers were facing another shutdown threat. But on December 2nd, after several days of talks, Congress reached an agreement to kick the can down the road another couple of months, passing a continuing resolution, a bill that will maintain government funding through February 18th. Everyone, including investors, breathed a sigh of relief that we are not adding a government shutdown to the list of factors affecting the economy right now. But the thing is, this really isn't much of an accomplishment at all, certainly not one that should be celebrated. It is perhaps the most basic responsibility of Congress to pass a budget and fund federal government operations each year. Yet year after year, Congress fails to do so. This was the 12th time this century that Congress failed to pass even a single one of the 12 appropriations bills by the time the fiscal year began on October 1st, according to the Tax Policy Center, a Washington think tank. The last time Congress passed all 12 by the deadline, 1997. In fact, Congress has only approved the 12 appropriations bills by October 1st 4 times since 1977. The reason this matters is because continuing resolutions do exactly what the name says. They continue the spending from the previous year. What they don't do is allow for any judgment or decisions on whether a program that was funded last year or 5 years ago or 25 years ago is worthy of being funded this year. Continuing resolutions just say, keep funding everything exactly as it was funded last year. For the Biden administration, in its first year in the White House, it means that it is funding programs at the same levels as they were funded during the previous administration. Now, all of this is not to say we should have a government shutdown. It's not in either party's interest, given everything else going on with our economy right now. But it certainly raises the question of what, if anything, can be done to improve a process that has only worked 4 times in the last 46 years. I don't expect there's an easy answer to that, but it sure seems like there must be a better way than going through this same drama every fall. Now, however, a much bigger drama looms as Congress once again wrestles with what to do about the debt ceiling. While the threat of a government shutdown, or even an actual government shutdown, has never been much of a market-moving event, debt ceiling crises have historically had a much bigger impact on the markets. Yet here we are again. We're here because in early October, as the date for the U.S. defaulting on its debts approached, Congress agreed to a very short-term fix, passing a bill that raised the debt limit by about $480 billion, or enough to avoid default for a couple of months. But time is now almost up, and Congress must once again raise the debt ceiling or risk an unprecedented U.S. default. What's not crystal clear at the moment is the actual deadline for when the limit must be raised. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said at the end of November that there were scenarios in which the Treasury would have insufficient funds to pay its obligations as soon as after December 15th. She followed that up last week while testifying on Capitol Hill, saying, quote, "I cannot overstate how critical it is that Congress address this issue. America must pay its bills on time and in full. If we do not, we will eviscerate our current recovery," end quote. Part of the reason for the December 15th focus is because that is the date when the new infrastructure law requires a transfer of $118 billion from the general fund to the Highway Trust Fund, where it can be allocated to highway projects around the country. That transfer will deplete much of what remains in that original $480 billion increase from October. That's why Yellen says that she can't be certain of whether the Treasury will have enough cash left to pay its bills after that date. But several outside analysts have suggested that Treasury will have additional flexibility past that date. They point out that December 15th is also the date when corporations pay their quarterly estimated tax payments, which should boost Treasury's cash flow temporarily. The Bipartisan Policy Center, a Washington think tank that is well-respected for its work on the debt ceiling, said last week that default could take place sometime between December 21st and January 28th, a span that underscores the imprecise nature of these calculations. Amidst these vague deadlines, the focus on Capitol Hill is on raising the debt ceiling before the Christmas holiday break. In the Senate, the stalemate between Republicans and Democrats generally remains unchanged from October. Republicans say that since Democrats have full control of the White House and both chambers of Congress, they should use the special budget reconciliation procedure to pass a debt ceiling increase without Republican support. That's possible, but it is cumbersome and time-consuming. The Democrats point out the fact that the nation's debt has been accumulated under presidents and Congresses of both parties, that lifting the debt limit has always been a bipartisan effort, and that it should be this year as well. So how will it get done? Well, that's still in the works. But there is a notable shift in tone coming from Capitol Hill as compared to October. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky have met multiple times recently to discuss the issue. Notably, neither has come out of these meetings trashing the other side. Neither, in fact, has said much at all about those meetings. But McConnell said last week, "Let me assure everyone the government will not default," which suggests that a compromise is in the works. By December 7th, there were multiple options on the table whereby Republicans would agree to some procedural steps to help Democrats fast-track legislation to raise the debt ceiling, but Republicans would not have to actually vote for a debt limit increase. Talks are ongoing as I record this podcast, but all signs point to getting the debt ceiling raised in time. Both sides would like to get this issue off the table until after the 2022 midterm elections, so look for a deal that raises the debt limit until late 2022 or early 2023. The key for investors will be to watch for when a plan to raise the debt limit becomes clear. Historically, we've seen more market volatility the closer we get to the deadline without a solution. If a clear path forward emerges late this week or early next week, that would be good for the markets and good for investors. Congress is also racing, well, perhaps crawling is the better word, toward the finish line on the Build Back Better Act, the roughly $2 trillion spending and tax package that focuses on climate change and social programs. The bill was approved by the House on November 19th, but the Senate does not even expect to begin consideration of it until next week at the earliest. The House-passed bill has significant implications for numerous different sectors of the economy. It includes more than $500 million in green energy and climate change investments, $400 billion to expand childcare, including universal preschool for all 3- and 4-year-olds, an expansion of Medicare to cover hearing services, 4 weeks of paid family and medical leave, as well as money for affordable housing, expanded home care and elder care services, prescription drug pricing, immigration reform, and more. But the Senate is widely expected to reduce the size and scope of the bill. Moderate senators, like Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, have consistently expressed concern not just with particular provisions, but with the overall size of the bill. Since all Democrats must vote for the bill in order to forge a 50-50 tie that can be broken by Vice President Kamala Harris, Manchin, Sinema, and other Democrats in the Senate who have expressed doubts hold an enormous amount of leverage. To pay for the bill, the Build Back Better legislation would create a new tax on the wealthiest Americans. A 5% tax would apply to income over $10 million, with an additional 3% surtax on income above $25 million. The bill would also tax large retirement savings balances, create a new 15% minimum tax for corporations, impose a 1% tax on stock buybacks, and significantly boost IRS spending in order to have more resources to crack down on underpayment and non-payment of taxes. All of those provisions are generally supported by most Senate Democrats, though a few have expressed concerns about some of the ideas. But by far the most controversial element of the tax side of the bill is the proposed increase in the cap on the state and local tax deduction, better known as the SALT deduction. The deduction was capped at $10,000 in 2017, a cap that has disproportionately impacted taxpayers in high-tax states like California, Illinois, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York. Members of Congress from these and other states pushed hard for an increase in the cap during negotiations in the House. And they got their wish. The Build Back Better Act that passed the House last month increases the cap to $80,000, a jump that few outside observers expected from a House controlled by Democrats. Now, the magnitude of the increase has split Democrats in the Senate. Progressives, like Senator Bernie Sanders, have said that the increase is a giveaway to the rich, a sentiment that has been shared publicly by several other senators. Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey tried to work with Sanders to put an income limit on who could take advantage of the increase, but they have not yet come to agreement. As of now, the fate of an increased cap remains uncertain, but it seems very likely that the final number will be something less than $80,000. The SALT deduction dispute is just one of many unresolved issues bedeviling Democrats in the Senate. Here again, Senator Manchin, the moderate Democrat from West Virginia, whose vote is essential to passing any bill, has a long list of objections, ranging from the overall size of the package itself to his desire to remove the 4 weeks of paid family and medical leave from the bill, a provision that is critical to progressive support for the bill. So careful negotiations within the Democratic Party are ongoing. With so many unresolved headaches on the bill, optimism that the Senate can pass it before the end of the year is waning. While Senate Majority Leader Schumer says that consideration of the bill will wrap up before Christmas, virtually no one in Washington believes that is possible. Several senators have already acknowledged that an early 2022 vote on the bill is likely. And remember, if and when the Senate passes a modified version of the bill, it will need to go back to the House of Representatives for a final vote there, which is no sure thing, depending on how much the Senate cuts from the version passed by the House last month. So the Build Back Better Act still has a very rocky path to the finish line. There's no question that passage of the legislation, if it happens, would have long-lasting implications for the economy. Coupled with the infrastructure bill that was signed into law last month, it would represent one of the most sweeping economic reform efforts in decades. Yet as big a deal as twin victories on the infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better Act would be for the White House, it may end up not being the most consequential act of President Biden's first term. That accolade may actually belong to the president's opportunity to reshape the Federal Reserve. Just before Thanksgiving, the president announced that he was renominating Jerome Powell for another 4-year term as chairman of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. I don't think this was much of a surprise. While there were a few voices on Capitol Hill pushing for change, Powell enjoys broad support from both parties. President Biden also nominated current Fed Governor Leo Brainard to be vice chair. Brainard is the only member of the Fed who was nominated by a Democratic president. She was confirmed in 2014 after having been nominated by President Obama. While some progressives in Washington wanted Brainard to get the chair position, elevating her to the number two spot was also a logical move for the White House. Powell and Brainard are not that different from one another, at least on monetary policy. Where they differ more is on the regulatory side of the equation, with progressives feeling that Powell has devoted too little time to bank regulation and that Brainard would be tougher on big banks. The nominations of Powell and Brainard to the top two spots at the seven-member Fed are likely to be confirmed. But that is just the beginning of President Biden's opportunity to put his imprint on the central bank for a decade or more. Fed governor terms are 14 years long and are staggered such that no more than one governor's term ends every 2 years. And Fed governors aren't subject to the whims of the next president. They serve out their full terms no matter what, potentially across multiple administrations, unless they choose to resign. Interestingly, due to resignations, Biden now has the ability to nominate three new governors at once, which is highly unusual and maybe unprecedented. The timing of these openings at the Fed could not be more significant for the markets. With inflation spiking to its highest rate in decades, the pressure on the Fed is enormous, and the debate over how quickly to raise interest rates to combat inflation is likely to be an explosive one over the next several months. We will get a preview of that debate next week, when the current Fed Open Markets Committee gathers for its final meeting of 2021. Just a month ago, the Fed announced that it would begin tapering its bond buying at a rate of $15 billion per month, beginning the unwinding of a key element of its pandemic response. At that pace, the Fed would be at its pre-pandemic levels by next summer, which signals an interest rate increase no earlier than the third quarter of 2022. Now, just a few weeks later, there is a growing expectation that the Fed will speed up the tapering process so that it is completed earlier next year, giving the Fed the flexibility to consider an interest rate increase even sooner. But whatever the Fed decides at next week's meeting, its meetings next year are likely to have a very different look and feel, with three new faces around the table once all three of the president's nominees are confirmed. And that has potentially enormous ramifications. For a lot of Americans, the Fed means just one thing: interest rates. But the Fed's power beyond interest rates really is staggering. The changing of a word or a phrase in their statements can move markets. The central bank's actions can touch on job creation, worker income, supply chains, currency valuations, economic growth, and more. That's why these decisions about who will be the next Fed governors are so important. The Fed prides itself on being apolitical, but there's no question that the nominees tend to reflect the political perspective of the president who nominates them. President Biden's choices are likely to focus not just on interest rates, but on issues like promoting job increases across a variety of demographics, cracking down on big banks and their executives, and using their tools to combat climate change. The political pressures on these vacancies are significant. Progressives on Capitol Hill were disappointed that the president renominated Powell to another term as chair, rather than elevating Brainard. Now, their focus is on the vacant vice chair for supervision slot. That position was created by the Dodd-Frank Act in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. It's the nation's most high-profile banking regulator, and Democrats feel that Randall Quarles, who was nominated to that post by President Trump, has been far too lax in his oversight of big banks. Liberals want to see a nominee who will tighten banking regulations and focus on issues like income inequality, cryptocurrency regulation, and the potential for climate change to impact financial stability. Now Quarles is retiring, and the White House is reportedly considering Richard Cordray for the slot. Cordray was the first head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the former Attorney General of Ohio. He is currently overseeing federal student aid for the Department of Education. He's a longtime ally of progressive Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is reportedly pushing for his nomination behind the scenes. But if Cordray is tapped for that position, it would bring up another challenge facing the president as he seeks to fill out the Fed roster. The president pledged when he nominated Powell and Brainard last month that his future nominations would bring new diversity to the Fed, which he said at the time was much needed and long overdue. He's right. Since the creation of the Federal Reserve as the nation's central bank in 1913, there have been just three black governors, all men. The six governors now, Powell, Brainard, Randall Quarles, Richard Clarida, Michelle Bowman, and Christopher Waller, are all white. And Cordray, the potential candidate for the vice chair for supervision seat, is also white. The White House is reportedly considering several diverse candidates for the open seats. Lisa Cook, a prominent economist at Michigan State University, reportedly tops the president's list. She would be the first black woman ever nominated for the Federal Reserve. Cecilia Rouse, another black woman and the chair of the president's White House Council of Economic Advisors, is also being considered. Rafael Bostic, the president of the Fed's regional bank in Atlanta, is also reported to be on the short list. He was the first black president of any of the Fed's 12 regional banks. And former Fed Vice Chair Roger Ferguson, who is the highest-ranking black official ever to serve at the Fed and who recently left his post as CEO of the giant teachers pension fund TIAA, is also reportedly under consideration for a return engagement at the central bank. No matter who is chosen, 2022 is going to see a flurry of confirmation hearings in the Senate Banking Committee. Powell needs to go through a hearing and another Senate vote to be confirmed his second four-year term as chair. Brainard would also need to be confirmed by the Senate to be elevated to vice chair. And all three of the new nominees would have to be approved on separate Senate votes. Senate Banking Committee Chairman Sherrod Brown has said he would like to hold confirmation hearings for Powell and Brainard before the Christmas holiday. But that's looking tricky, since both are currently in the 10-day quiet period that precedes each Fed meeting. The Fed meets next week on December 14th and 15th. That means it's unlikely that a confirmation hearing could be held before the week of December 20th, when the Senate is supposed to be on recess for the holiday break, though it is realistic to think that senators will be in Washington for at least part of that week, given the other pressing issues on the docket. The important thing for investors to watch is who the president chooses and how quickly they can get confirmed. After that, we will all be watching to see how quickly Fed policies may change. That's all for this week's episode of Washington Wise Investor. With the holidays ahead, we'll be off for the rest of the year. But we'll be back with new episodes in January. So please take a moment now to follow the show in your listening app so you don't miss the next episode. And if you like what you've heard, leave us a rating or a review. That really helps new listeners discover the show. For important disclosures, see the show notes or schwab.com/WashingtonWise, where you can also find a transcript. Finally, this podcast wouldn't be possible without a great team that does an amazing amount of work far away from the microphone. So thanks to Gay Mathis, Patrick Ritchie, Deborah Hinton Brown, Pete Knezovich, and Jamal Mobley for their fantastic work to make this podcast a success in 2021. I'm Mike Townsend, and this has been Washington Wise Investor. Wherever you are, stay safe, stay healthy, have a great holiday season, and keep investing wisely.